32. Doug followed Seth and the prisoner, Murdoch, out behind the building. He thought about recording it because the perp walk and the mysterious stranger would have been great material for a future documentary. But then the reality of things crashed down on him again. Monsters in every city. Autumn screaming at him. Plus, he didn't know how Seth would react. The man had gotten harder and harder to read as they learned of the other monsters, and night fell. Doug wouldn't put it past him to lash out. Did Seth have friends or family in one of the big cities?
"You don't need to do this," said Murdoch.
Seth gave the man's shoulder a quick, hard shake.
"Shut up. I'm on your side. I want to find a way out of this just as much as you do."
"I doubt that," Doug chimed in. They rounded the back corner of the building. Doug wasn't sure why he'd expected something more like a backyard, just the same clearing stretching the same distance from the building with the same vines and moss covering everything. The wall looked flatter here than the front, but he couldn't even be sure of that with all the plants covering it. Seth turned to Doug and gestured at the building.
"Look for that drain pipe he told us about."
"Why me?"
"Because I'm watching the prisoner."
"I'm not exactly a flight risk," said Murdoch.
"How many times have I told you to shut up?
Enough that it's getting boring."
Doug sighed and started pushing vines aside. The back door had been mostly cleared, but overall the growth seemed even thicker on this side of the building. He wondered if it was a directional thing. Plants grew better facing some directions than others, if he remembered right. He debated pulling out his tablet and using it as a light again. He didn't have an actual flashlight app on it, but any white screen worked just as well. The battery had read 63% last he checked, but he had a portable charger in his pack. Something pricked his finger and he swore.
"What's wrong now?"
asked Seth.
"The vines."
Doug held up his hand to show the pink scratch.
"They don't have thorns, but some of these little branches are really stiff."
"Just find the damned pipe."
Doug pushed his hands back into the vines and tried not to flinch when a trio of thumb-sized cockroaches came scuttling out. One dropped onto his sleeve and he brushed it away. It landed on the ground and pitter-pattered back into the vines at the base of the building. He stepped back and looked at the wall. Alex had said the pipe was on the corner, and he'd pointed more this way than that. Doug took a few steps to his left and felt his way through the vines again. He pushed his hands through to the bricks again and again, yanked them away from a particularly large roach that tickled the back of his fingers, and then rapped his knuckles on something hard.
"Think I found it,"
he said, bending back a bunch of leaves with his forearm. Rust flowered across the pipe, but it still felt thick and solid. Doug picked at a few spots but couldn't get more than a bit of orange dust to float free. He pushed some more growth away and found a thick bracket holding the pipe against the building. Seth elbowed him out of the way and pushed Murdoch up against the wall, almost burying his face in the leaves and vines. He raised the pistol, tapped the back of Murdoch's head with it.
"Right at the base of your skull,"
he said.
"Don't try anything."
"I'm not going to try anything,"
Murdoch said with a sigh. Seth fished the key ring from his pocket and handed it to Doug. Doug stared at him and got an eye roll back.
"Cuff him to the pipe."
"Why me?"
"Because it takes two hands and I'm holding the gun."
"I could hold the gun."
"I'm not giving you the gun."
Doug leaned a little closer to Seth.
"His hands creep me out."
"Oh, for fuck's sake," said Murdoch. "Do you want me to do it myself?"
Seth smacked Doug's shoulder. Doug stepped forward, trying hard not to get distracted by Murdoch's pale, webbed fingers. He'd read some of the Hannibal Lecter books after getting into the TV show, and he remembered a whole bit where Lecter escaped the FBI because everyone was looking at his extra finger and not at the other hand holding a lockpick. Doug wasn't going to make the same mistake, even though he didn't see how Murdoch could hide a lockpick between his fingers. He fumbled the key into the lock and one cuff fell open. Murdoch flexed his fingers once, spreading the membranes between them wide. Doug shuddered and took a step back.
"Move," said Seth. "Put them on both sides of the pipe."
Murdoch obeyed. Doug stepped back in and fumbled in the darkness between the drain pipe and the building. He pulled the cuff through, wrapped it back around Murdoch's wrist, and snapped it tight.
"I'm so glad I found you guys," Murdoch said to the wall. "You're so much more rational than my religious nut family members."
Seth muttered something under his breath. Doug stepped back. "So now what? Do we just leave him here?"
"No, he could start yelling. Lead his people here." "They're not my people anymore," Murdoch said.
"Well then," said Doug, "I guess I'm going to go inside with Chase and the others."
Seth shook his head.
"You're staying out here with me."
"Why?"
"So I'm not alone with the prisoner."
"Why can't... Are you going to do something to him, like Gitmo stuff?"
Even in the dark, he could see Seth's scowl.
"I just don't want to be alone out here, idiot."
"Calling me an idiot isn't a great way to make me stay out here with you."
"Then it's a good thing you're a better person than I am."
Doug considered going back in anyway, but Seth had really backed him into a corner. Instead, he tugged his phone back out and looked for Bars. "I'm going to see if there's any more news."
"Sure, whatever."
He pulled his tablet from his pack and opened a few windows. Almost a third of the live streams he'd been watching before had ended. He wondered how many of them were dead and how many had just decided to stop filming and run. He'd always mocked found footage movies when the cameraman didn't drop everything and run in the face of obvious danger, and he wondered if he was being proven very right or very wrong. He looked over at Seth. "What's closer, Cairo or Hong Kong?"
"Cairo, by a lot."
Doug curled his lips. "The one in Cairo looks like it's leveled most of the city. There's only a couple people still streaming video there."
"So?"
"So maybe it'll come here next."
"Lot of Africa between here and there," said Seth. "It'll run into a few other cities first. Khartoum, Mogadishu, Nairobi."
Doug pictured the monster, the squale, Veek had called it, eating its way through a bunch of African cities. He wondered if any of them was strong enough to slow it down. Murdoch cleared his throat and turned his head as best he could.
"Excuse me. Are you saying there's more than one of them in the world already? They've all gotten loose?"
"How many is all?" asked Doug. Murdoch shrugged as best he could.
"I don't really know. More than one. Less than 20, I think."
"Isn't this, like, your religion?"
"I stopped paying attention in Sunday school and I barely remember most of that, but I know more of them is worse." "I'm not in a cult and I could tell you that," said Seth.
Murdoch turned his head back to the wall.
"Just trying to help."
Doug shifted through a couple more videos and found another live stream from Los Angeles. Someone two or three stories up looking down at different buildings. He caught a glimpse of the El Capitan with its big, old-fashioned marquee sign. The viewpoint was high enough up to see over the buildings and across the city. The monster loomed in the sky, ripping up palm trees, scooping up cars, gathering all of it up into itself. It looked, to Doug, like half the buildings were on fire. The flames all spiraled up to smother against the monster's vast underside. Or maybe it sucked them in through its pores, eating the fire and ash and smoke like it ate everything else. That would explain why missiles didn't hurt it. A faint squeal came from the tablet speakers, and whoever was behind the live stream tilted their phone or webcam down to street level. An oversized pickup truck sat in the middle of the street, a bit of rubber on the pavement behind it. A quartet of men in baseball caps piled out. Doug thought they looked like gym rat office workers or weekend cowboys. Then he saw the one in the back of the truck throwing rifles out to each of them. The sound was muffled, but he heard the distant pop, pop, pop of gunfire. The squale didn't seem to notice, but one of its tentacles swept down out of the sky and carried away the truck, with the one poor bastard pinned in the back. The others scattered. The person holding the camera let out a few dry laughs. Seth perked up.
Did you just hear a gunshot?
Doug held the tablet a little higher.
I think it might have been on the video. It looks like... I think some right-wing militia guys are trying to fight one of those things. It's not going well for them.
Good, said Seth. Stupid Americans.
Hey! Seth waved him off, or maybe gave him the finger. It was hard to tell in the dark. Doug crunched some snacks between his teeth and scrolled through a few more streams. Most of them didn't have titles, and the ones that did weren't all that helpful. Monster Attacking My City, or The End Is Here. One person had titled theirs, Cthulhu Has Risen. Doug hadn't read any of those old stories, but he'd seen enough about H.P. Lovecraft online to know it was more or less appropriate. One video caught his eye. A woman out of New York, if her bio was accurate, she had the camera on herself out at arm's length. The squale filled most of the skyline behind her. She had delicate features like an elf in some fantasy movie, but tears had left dark streaks of makeup across her cheeks. Her clothes looked like office wear. He pulled up the video.
Can't imagine how many people it's killed, she said. It's been making its way across the city for hours. There were a couple people up here on the roof with me. Some of them joked about having an end-of-the-world party, but nobody laughed, and now they've all left. Some of them, I think most people are trying to hide now. I've been alone up here for about an hour, maybe. I kind of lose track of time when I look at it.
The background spun behind her as the woman turned to look at the monster again.
I almost went with them, she said. I should probably go try to calm Quasimodo, my cat, or maybe let him out so he can run for it, but there's just no point.
She closed her eyes for a moment, and tears started to run down her face again.
There's no point. It's going to eat us all. It's going to eat everything. It's so hungry.
The words drove spikes into Doug, and his eyes burned. He paused with his hand halfway to his mouth.
I think it's talking to me,
the woman continued.
It's broadcasting its thoughts or speaking on some other frequency or something. It's in my head, and it's so very hungry. And where it's prey, just pray for it to eat. It's so hungry, it's going to eat the world.
She tipped her head back just a bit, and the streaks on her face gleamed red. Not makeup at all. As Doug watched, a fresh stream of blood dribbled from the woman's nose.
So hungry for prey, she said just before he closed the video,
and then the whole window. He shoved the tablet back into his pack. Where were his snacks? Had he finished all of them?
How bad is it? Asked Seth.
We're fucked, Doug said. Completely, utterly bent over the couch, fucked. Even if we get out of here, I don't know if there's going to be anything left out there.
It's only been a couple of hours.
Doug shook his backpack.
You want to tell that to everyone in Tokyo?
They don't need long, said Murdoch.
He talked into the vines, not even turning his head this time.
My Auntie Bradbury used to say they could clean the world in 2 weeks' time if enough of them got through.
He raised his hands as best he could and snapped his fingers. The sound echoed in the dark. Doug stood up, pulled the pack onto his shoulders, and heard the snap echo again. As he turned, something grabbed his pack hard and tried to yank it away. By the time he responded, the pressure had vanished, but an elastic tension remained, as if the backpack had gotten snagged on something. A hard crack echoed out, wood on stone, and Murdoch screamed. A giant firecracker lit up the night, then another, and a third. Seth shouted something that got lost in the aftermath of the gunshots. A white line flicked past him, and he fired two more times. Doug tried to duck, but whatever held his backpack kept him upright. He struggled against it for a moment, then raised his arms and wiggled down out of the straps. He glanced back and watched the pack slide down the length of a light gray pole. Seth fired two more times. He shouted something in a language Doug didn't recognize. His pistol went off again, and then froze, its top extended back over the base of his thumb. Doug had seen enough movies to know what that meant. Murdoch yelled, too, also in another language. He shouted out a few halting syllables and clicks, straining to be heard over the gunshots. He kept it up after Seth's pistol ran dry, shouting himself hoarse. The building's back door swung open, and Chase and Veek tumbled out. Chase had his gun drawn like a TV cop. Alex came a few steps behind them, lugging what looked like an oversized car headlight attached to a long cable. "What's happening?" yelled Chase.
"Ambush," snarled Seth. "Something in the trees attacked us with spears."
Alex straightened up from his device and a beam of white light blasted out into the forest. He panned it back and forth.
"The Seraphs," he said. "Normally they avoid the machine."
Doug looked over at Murdoch. The prisoner's chin dropped to his chest. He sagged against the building, cradling the drainpipe with his arms. Then Doug looked at his backpack with the spear through it. Seth reached out, calmly took Chase's pistol and handed him the empty one.
"I used up my last rounds,"
he explained. He phrased it low, but his baritone rumbled through the dark.
"They could still be out there," Chase said.
"That's why I took your gun."
The backwash from Alex's spotlight lit up the rear of the building. He looked around and shook his head.
"Doubtful. Spears are a one-use weapon, and the Seraphs almost never carry more than one apiece. They most likely threw these and fled."
"Most likely," echoed Vig.
"Again, they normally avoid the machine. I haven't seen them attack like this in almost 50 years.
Doug pointed at Murdoch.
"He called them."
Murdoch let out a grunt.
"No, I didn't,"
he said through gritted teeth.
"Oh, shit, you're bleeding."
Chase crouched near Seth's leg. A spear had sliced the fabric open like a pass from the sharpest scissors. Blood seeped down from a razor-straight line.
"I'm fine. Just give me a bandage or some duct tape."
"Not sure we've got either."
"Then I'll be fine."
"I'm telling you,"
Doug said a little louder.
"He was talking to them."
Chase looked up from Seth's wound.
"Can you talk to them?"
"A little," Murdoch said. "Not really. They teach us the old language when we're kids. I only remember a couple of words."
"He told them to attack us,"
yelled Doug.
"They were attacking before I said anything."
"That's what you say."
"Yeah."
He twisted his head away from the building to glare at Doug.
"That's what I say."
Murdoch's gaze dropped to the shadows around his legs. One of the dark shapes flickered white in the backwash of Alex's floodlight. The spear trembled as Murdoch moved.
"Damn it,"
said Veek. The spear skewered the meat of Murdoch's thigh a few inches above his knee. Blood streaked along the end leading into the building's vines. The other end dragged on the ground. It had twisted his cargo pants as it hit and then seesawed in his leg. Doug noticed the spear had conveniently missed the bone, just a flesh wound. No permanent damage, probably. The kind of thing people did in movies to build sympathy, to prove they're victims, too. He decided to put it out there first so nobody else had to.
"I say we kill him just to be safe."
He waited for someone to agree with him. Nobody did. Chase looked at Murdoch's wound. Veek peered over his shoulder. He reached for the spear close to the entry point, but stopped before he touched it.
"Does it hurt?"
"It's a fucking javelin impaling my leg. Yes, it fucking hurts."
"Good," said Doug. "I still say we should shoot him."
Seth smacked the back of his neck, hard.
"We're not shooting a man in chains."
"Then take the handcuffs off him." "I believe Douglas and I concur on this," said Alex. "We can't trust him. It will be simpler to kill him."
"We are not killing a man in chains," Seth repeated.
"I would guess 100 million people have died in the past half hour,"
Alex waved his free hand at the trees, but they all saw the real gesture. He waved his hand at the world. More than 1 billion will be dead before the next sunset. One more death won't matter.
It matters to me, said Chase.
A tense moment stretched out between Chase and Alex. All the others paused, waiting to see what happened next. Even Murdoch set his jaw, his big eyes flitting between the two men. Doug felt his confidence crumble.
Of course, said Alex. Forgive me and my panic. Survival at any price is hardly survival.
Chase glared at him, then turned back to Murdoch's wound.
I don't think you're supposed to pull things out of puncture wounds.
That sounds right, said Murdoch with a nod.
Break it off, said Seth. Leave that part in him.
I don't think we can break it off without doing a lot more damage, Chase said.
Why do you care? Asked Murdoch.
What?
Don't get me wrong, I'm grateful, just a little confused. Why not just let them kill me?
Chase looked up at the huge eyes, then back to the spear. He took a breath and pushed the memories of Dina from his mind.
I haven't seen a lot of death, but what I saw was enough. Definitely don't need to be part of any more, especially with somebody who's handcuffed and helpless.
Murdoch nodded slowly.
That's too bad.
Why? Murdoch looked up at the sky.
Because there's a lot of death coming.
Doug followed his gaze upward. He thought of the woman in the live stream with the bleeding eyes, just like his had been bleeding. The woman who heard their voices in his head. The woman who'd felt their hunger.
Do you guys want to get a room or something?
Asked Veek, interrupting Doug's thoughts. Chase shot her a look, then looked at the wound again.
I know it's bad, but I think, all things considered, our best bet is to pull the spear out.
Murdoch's jaw shifted.
If we had tools or something, maybe we could cut it off, but
he glanced over at Alex. The other man shook his head.
Nothing close.
Chase turned away.
We're going to need something to use as a bandage.
He looked at Veek. She stared back at him, then shook her head.
No, screw you, no, we're not doing the woman tears up her shirt for bandages thing.
You're the only one with long sleeves.
Doug has long sleeves.
This is vintage, said Doug, putting one hand up over his shirt.
And did I mention the screw you know part of this?
Doug saw something flutter through the air and land on Chase's shoulder, a balled-up handkerchief, blue with dozens of white paisleys on it.
Shut up and use it, said Seth.
Chase snapped the handkerchief open.
Is it clean?
Seth shrugged.
Infection's pretty low on my list of worries right now, said Murdoch.
Okay, then,
Chase set his hands on the back half of the spear. It quivered, and Murdoch bit back a grunt.
You know this is going to hurt like fuck all, right?
Just get on with it.
A breeze danced across Doug's eyes, strong enough to force a blink. He glanced up at the trees and saw their shadows sway against the night sky.
On three?
Asked Chase. Murdoch nodded and pulled his arms close to the drainpipe again. Chase's lips silently counted to two before he yanked. The spear resisted. It had been thrown so hard it was caught in the bricks of the building. He yanked again, ignoring a whine from Murdoch, and something crumbled behind the vines. The spear's tip appeared from between some leaves. Even in the unsteady light, Doug could see the barbs, but it was already in motion. It snagged on Murdoch's pants, caught again on the muscles of his thigh, and ripped free with a juicy noise like spare ribs tearing off the bone. Murdoch screamed. Blood spurted out. Chase tossed the spear aside, whipped out the handkerchief, and wrapped it around the gaping hole in Murdoch's leg. Then he pulled it loose and wrapped it again, covering more of the gory wound. He spun the ends between his fingers and pulled the knot tight. Murdoch roared into the vines, and his cry rang up along the drainpipe. Doug turned slowly, looking at as many dark treetops as he could. The tops bobbed back and forth now, shoved around by the wind. It rattled their trunks, too.
It's a mess, said Chase. But I think he'll be okay. You a doctor now?
Asked Seth. I took a first aid class once.
Still probably makes you the most qualified.
Murdoch got his breathing under control.
Thanks.
They all kept talking, but Doug focused on the trees. A low surge of wind pushed out from the forest to make his hair flutter. Even the longer whiskers of his beard moved. It faded, and then swelled again a few moments later, like breathing, or a slow heartbeat, or wings. Guys, he said. Another stronger surge of wind from the trees. Dark clouds rolled in, were shoved into his view, blotting out the few stars he could see. One of them flared, lit up by internal lighting. The faint echo of thunder rumbled down out of the sky, almost sounding like whispered words as it brushed his ears. Guys, it's back!
33.
Katanga crouched behind a weedy fern of some kind and watched the cult people spread out as best they could along the edge of the clearing. By his count, there were only five of them left, one of them being Judah, the man with the crushed limb. He had a rifle propped in the crook of his good arm, but Katanga had fired enough weapons to know how that would work out once the man pulled the trigger. It turned out there were also more of the monster creatures than he'd thought. At least four of them, altogether. They dropped out of trees and stalked out of the shadows. The supermodel minister babbled grunted instructions to them. They drifted out to join the lines surrounding the vine-covered building. She had a quick conversation with the skull-faced man, Barnabas, which Katanga couldn't hear well enough to understand. A breeze had picked up, just enough to make the leaves and grass scrape against each other. They made a soft white noise that was very annoying while he tried to eavesdrop. The cult people propped up their few electric torches with rocks. Barnabas attached his to his rifle. Altogether, they lit up the building enough for Katanga to make out a few details. Considering its location and age, going off all the growth, he would have guessed it to be some old military building, maybe some kind of bunker or fortification, but it seemed much more civilian, like an old hotel or apartment building. There were steps in the front leading to a big door. Numerous windows, but many of them had been covered with planks and wide boards. They weren't well lit, but it seemed like many of the planks had seen better days, and those days had been decades ago. One of the cloaked monsters took a few awkward steps into the clearing. Katanga watched it raise and plant a foot, and even in the shadows it was clear the creature walked on something closer to a hoof. It rolled its shoulder, pushing the cloak back, and raised its spear. Its arm blurred back and forward, and the spear cracked into one of the wooden planks on a second-floor window. The board creaked as the spear tilted down, and they crashed to the ground together. The open space left behind let out a soft glow. It reminded Katanga of Makara's bridge with the lights out, lit just by the panels of instruments. Then a thunderous gunshot echoed across the clearing and the monster flapped all three of its arms wildly. It let out a chattering howl, spun around, took a clumsy step toward the trees, then changed course and took two more in Katanga's direction. He sucked in a breath and the creature veered off again, heading back into the clearing. At its new angle, he could see the spurts of blood coming from its head. It dropped to one knee and tried to keep moving forward with its other leg. A second shot hit it in the chest and it flopped to the ground. One of its hands twitched open and closed, and then stopped. Its unnatural body relaxed. The minister woman screamed. The other creatures let out a few stuttering, clicking roars. Another spear cracked against the frame of the same window. The leaves and vines rippled as 20 or 30 rounds blasted into the building. A few of them sparked against stonework. Somewhere, glass broke. The loud, distinct shot came from the building again, and a tree next to the minister spat out a mouthful of wood and pulp. She dropped. Katanga thought she'd been hit, but a moment later she crawled away. It had just been damned close. There was some piss in her pants, he'd wager. Just piss, if she had good self-control. Another spear went at the building, then some more bullets. They were shooting wildly, he realized. They knew, they suspected, the shots were coming from a window or the roof, but they had no real idea. It had all happened fast, and Katanga couldn't recall seeing a muzzle flash either. Whoever was shooting back at them could be anywhere. Judah, the man with the broken arm, finally pulled the trigger on his rifle, and it went just as Katanga figured it would. The weapon jumped and kicked. Judah twisted around, trying to keep it braced, and scattered shots across the clearing. The rifle threw itself away from him, but stayed hooked on his finger, so it got to fire off two more rounds almost straight down. He wailed and stumbled away from the spray of dirt. His broken arm slapped into a tree, and the wail became a shriek.
"Stupid bastard," thought Katanga.
He heard another of the heavier rifle shots ring out, followed by another gargling growl, and then another angry yell from the minister. She seemed more upset about the monsters being shot than her own people. Another spear, some more bullets. Katanga wondered how long they were going to waste time trying to hit someone they couldn't see. Then he spotted the skull-faced man, barely a shadow and just a few yards away. Barnabas crouched with his rifle up to his cheek, staring down the iron sights, focused, patient. The rifle kicked once, then two more times in quick succession. Katanga swung his head back in time to catch a flurry of motion on the second floor, right by the front corner of the building. A figure leaned out, flailed at the window frame, caught itself before one of the boards across a window broke free. Another one split lengthwise with a crack. Katanga saw a flash of bright white beard, even whiter in the harsh light of the torches, as the old man tumbled out of the window. His hand grabbed at the sill, spun him around, but momentum and gravity had him. He plunged down to the ground and hit upright. One of his legs made a sound almost exactly like the splitting plank, and Katanga cringed. The old man dropped face first to the ground, caught himself, and tried to crawl. The minister stalked out into the clearing after him, pulling something from her hip as she did. Barnabas and the big woman followed a few steps behind her.
"You don't understand,"
the old man's voice whistled through gritted teeth. The minister held up a knife with a white curved blade.
"I understand more than you ever have."
"They'll kill everyone. Everyone. They won't spare."
She slashed at the old man's throat. He got his hands up to defend himself, and she swept the blade across his exposed stomach. Then she crouched and stabbed it into his chest. His flailing arms tried to knock her away, to protect himself, but she stabbed again and again. Red splashed on the blade, on him, on her. The man shouted, then screamed, and then his voice faded as she buried the knife in his chest with a two-handed thrust.
"More lies,"
she spat out. A gust of wind carried her words across the clearing and swung her braid back and forth behind her, like a cat swishing its tail. Even mostly from behind, Katanga thought it made her beautiful and terrifying all at once. He set his hands down, lowering himself to all fours, shifted one knee back, then the other. He kept his eyes ahead, watching the people by the building as he felt his way backward. The minister was speaking, but the breezes were rattling the grass and leaves again. He'd backed up about 10 or 12 feet when he risked raising himself into a low crouch. Another 10 feet shuffling backward, and almost none of the light from the clearing touched him. He straightened up a little more, took a few more slow, backward steps, and then turned and walked straight into a tree. Somehow Katanga didn't make a noise. Neither did the tree. Its bark scraped his face a bit, but it was soft enough to absorb most of the impact. The tree unfolded, and a tooth-filled face looked down at him.
34. As soon as the white-hot static of pain faded from his brain, Murdoch smelled the salt on the wind. A strong wind, growing stronger by the second, getting pushed off the ocean and carrying a sea mist with it. It prickled his nostrils. A call to home and a warning, all in one. He tried to turn, but the handcuffs grabbed at his wrists, jerking him back to the iron drainpipe. The shudder rolled off his shoulders, down his back, and shook his freshly bandaged leg. He craned his head to look at the sky. The building and its rooftop overhang took up so much of his view, but he could just see a few dark clouds rolling in and smell the sharp tang of ozone as lightning came with them. He glanced over at the others. The woman, Veek, looked around. She sensed it, too, even if she hadn't identified it. So had the man, Alex. He headed over to the building's rear door. The guy with the accent, Seth, followed him, although Murdoch got the sense it was out of suspicion more than anything else. Chase and Veek joined them.
"What's going on?"
Alex waved them through the door.
"Inside, please."
"Why?"
"Please, inside, now."
Chase eyed the man suspiciously but went in, Veek just a few steps behind.
"Hey," said Murdoch.
"Guys,"
wailed the hipster with the goofy hat and the blood-filled eyes.
"Guys, it's back!"
Then he looked around and realized the others were already heading inside. Seth gave him an impatient wave, and the hipster scampered for the door.
"Hey!" Murdoch called out. He jangled the handcuffs. "What about me?"
The blood-eyed hipster glanced back, then turned to Alex. Alex muttered something Murdoch couldn't hear, but apparently it satisfied the hipster. He followed the others inside. The faint mist became actual raindrops as the wind swelled and picked up speed. Murdoch stared at Alex and swallowed.
"You don't have the keys, do you?"
"I do not. I am so very sorry, but there's just too much at risk. I cannot trust you near the machine."
He pulled the door shut. The lock slid home. The rain came down.
"You fuckers," growled Murdoch.
He heard voices shouting inside the building, but the wind crashing through the trees drowned them out. It surged again and again, and Murdoch could picture the huge wings driving it, pounding down. The wind ripped at his hair and clothes. He pushed himself closer to the building, trying to shelter as best he could behind the drainpipe. The cuffs held his wrists just right, kept him from wrapping his hands around it, forced one of his arms out in the open to be scoured and chilled by the wind. He closed his eyes and buried his face in the vines around the pipe. A new sound reached his ears, brought to him by the hurricane winds, the crash of waves followed by the rush of water over ground. Big waves, crashing close by, even though he had to be at least a half mile from the beach, maybe a full mile, and then a series of long, splintering cracks, the sound of tree trunks breaking, or maybe being torn away. Murdoch's foot slipped on the rain-slicked ground. The howling wind grabbed at his wounded leg, twisting his jeans around just enough to send a jolt of agony up through his side. He dragged his foot back and pressed himself tighter against the building. The gale sucked the heat from his fingers as it whipped across his knuckles. It pushed on his eyelids until it forced out tears. It caught his lips and shook his cheeks. Leaves slapped him. Vines lashed him. No matter how much he tried to flatten himself against the wall, his chest caught the wind like a sail. It pounded against him, rain blasting him like thousands of bullets. He hooked his fingers as best he could on the drain pipe, willing them not to slip, tried to dig his nails into the rusted iron, squeezed it between his palms. The world outside of his eyelids darkened. The wind shifted. He risked tilting his head back and squinting through slitted eyes. The wind forced them shut almost instantly, but Murdoch saw the bat-like wing of the Great One stretch out across the sky. His foot slipped again in the mud and his fingers slid from the pipe. The wind yanked him away from the wall. The handcuffs caught him, his arms locked straight, and sent a dull ache throbbing out from both elbows. He tried to grab the pipe again, but the cuffs pulled tight across it, keeping his wrists trapped.
He kicked at the ground, tried to lunge back toward the pipe, but the hurricane force pounded his shins, his thighs. It twisted and jabbed at the wound in his leg. His feet slid again and again, stretching him out away from the wall. He dug his toes into the ground and felt them slide back out. He heard a sharp crack, breaking wood. The wind peeled off one of the boards covering the windows. Something grabbed him, wrapping around his arms and neck. Murdoch screamed in terror, and then realized it was a few tangled lengths of ivy, swinging free of the building. He kept screaming anyway. The wind tried to force the sounds back down his throat, choking him with his fear. His toes came away from the ground as the wind picked him up. The handcuffs scraped on the pipe. His body rocked back and forth in the air. His wounded leg could have been on fire, a coal-hot blaze in his thigh. Another scrape of steel on iron. He hung by the handcuffs now, and they gouged his wrists. The wind battered his chest, pummeled his head, beat at his legs. His feet dangled behind him. No. Even with the nightmare of wind and pain, his arms slowly pulling free of their sockets, his sense of balance insisted his feet. Another grinding scrape and a lurch he felt in his gut. His feet were above him. The cuffs were holding him down, keeping the tornado winds from hurling him up into the sky, up toward. The cuffs cut into his wrists as the wind lifted him higher. No, not the wind. It was drawing him up, sucking him in. Him, the trees, the rain, even the air itself. Murdoch risked another glimpse over his shoulder. The Great One loomed over him. It filled the sky. His eyes throbbed and watered at the sight of such glorious, unending hunger, even as its shadow devoured his warmth. The handcuffs shifted on the iron drain pipe. They stopped sliding with a clink he felt, more than heard, caught on one of the supports that jutted out from the wall, holding the pipe in place. His shoulders burned as his feet and legs kept trying to drag him up into the sky, into the Great One. A low hum echoed up through the pipe. It grew louder in seconds, like a car approaching at high speed. The handcuffs vibrated. Something washed up over him like a gust of warm air or a gentle wave and surged off into the sky. Thunder hammered Murdoch's ears. Pain made his eyes wince closed, breaking the squale's spell over him. The wind shifted, pummeled him again, and slammed him into the side of the building. Bare bricks scratched his arms and tore at his bandaged leg. His body dragged down the side of the building, scraping through the stiff vines and along the bricks. The handcuffs scraped again, but now they pulled up, slowing his descent, but not by much. He shook his head clear. The wind receded quickly, taking his lift with it. He opened his eyes and saw the ground coming at him. He flailed, hugged the drain pipe with his elbows, then wrapped his knees on either side. A desperate fireman who remembered at the last minute to grab the pole. Murdoch landed on the ground. The impact shot up from his heels, taking a few moments to rattle around inside his wounded thigh before it forced its way out his throat as a wail of pain. A last gust of wind slapped him in the back of his head and shoulders. He dropped to his knees, and a support on the drainpipe yanked his hands up. Kneeling tightened the flesh of his legs and sent a burning throb out from his wound. He stayed there, on his knees, hands up, and tried to figure out if he was praying or surrendering. 35. Veek glared at Alex as he herded them through the door.
You said we had 4 hours before it came back.
I assumed it would follow their usual feeding patterns, he told her. That it would follow a path of maximum intake to reach here. Nothing ever suggested they would make the destruction of the machine a higher priority.
Well, it looks like they did, said Chase.
Alex gestured Doug in and pulled the door shut. His fingers twisted a series of locks, one after another, then turned a key that vanished into one of his vest pockets.
We have a chance to drive it off if we act quickly.
He pushed past them and ran down the catwalk, stretching through the machine. "Hey, wait," said Chase. "What about the guy, Murdoch?" He stepped back and tried to open the door. "Quickly," yelled Alex as he bounded up the stairs. Veek ran after him. Footsteps clanged on the catwalk behind her. It felt odd to see the building with no wood and plaster covering its inside walls, like she was running through a mechanical duplicate. Up the stairs, across another catwalk, and just a quick glance over at the tall door leading to a blocky chamber, the one enclosed room in the entire machine. Power cables wrapped around it and a thin layer of what might have been rubber coated every seam and edge. And then she was inside the control area with all of its switches and dials. Chase stepped in a moment later. "You left him out there?" Alex flipped a row of switches down with the side of his hand. "We do not have time for this." He sidestepped, twisting 3, 4, 5 knobs one after another, turning each one as far as he could. Veek looked down through the machine, trying to pick out the back door. The wind howled across the outside corners of the building. She didn't like or trust Murdoch, but the thought of him chained outside, exposed and unable to protect himself, made her gut burn.
"What the hell is wrong with you? He could die out there."
Chase took a step forward, his fingers curling into fists again.
"We cannot take the risk," snapped Alex.
He took 3 quick steps, checked a wall of dials, and then spun another knob.
"The system is too fragile, especially now. The slightest problem could cause a collapse before we're ready, and I will not allow that."
Chase's fist came up, and Veek felt her own fingers tighten.
"If you can control your base instincts for 2 minutes, there is still a chance we can survive this. If we do, you may feel free to strike me then."
Chase glanced toward the back door, too, and then he let out an angry snort.
"What are you trying to do? Quickly, then."
Alex pointed at a few different panels of equipment and rattled off some terms Veek vaguely understood. Hardware had never been her thing. Chase seemed to get it, though. He ran across the control room, studied one of the panels, and began to flip switches. Alex flipped a large knife switch, turned 3 more knobs, then locked eyes with Veek and pointed past her.
"That bank there."
She turned. An array of glowing vacuum tubes filled the wall behind her. Each one was staggered and slightly higher, like the tiny steps of a museum display, packing as much as possible into the case while still making them all visible.
"On my signal," said Alex. "Break the 3rd valve from the left, 4th row up, 2nd row back."
"Valve?"
"The vacuum tube," Chase explained from his panel.
"Break it?"
"Destroy it," Alex confirmed with a quick nod.
"Got it."
She squinted at the glowing array, counted off spaces, and found her target. Alex wrapped his hands around a large lever with a bicycle grip-like handle. He leaned into it, inching the lever higher. As he did, the low hum of the machine rose to the frantic buzz of a huge insect swarm. She looked around for a tool, a stick, anything. Alex kept his control room much cleaner than the one back in Los Angeles. She patted her clothes out of habit, but the family had cleaned everything out of her pockets. The buzz grew into the angry drone of a hive. Alex kept pushing the lever.
"In 3, 2, 1.
Now," Veek gritted her teeth, shoved her fingers past the front row, and grabbed the tube with her bare hand. She felt a tingle, a sense of pain rushing up her arm, and she twisted the hot glass as hard as she could. It splintered and sliced into her palm with a loud pop. The vacuum tubes on either side of it burst an instant later, showering her fingers with more glass. The other tubes, all the other lights in the machine, flared brighter. A blast of what felt like warm, static-filled air rose up from the lower levels. She could almost see it, like a faint heat mirage. It flowed over her and left her skin with a shivering, tingling feeling. The lights faded back to normal. The buzz of electricity faded back to a gentle hum, and beneath that, the sound of the wind rubbing against the building faded too. Alex slumped against the wall next to his lever. Blood leaked from his nose again, Chase staggered and bent over, looking like a drunk getting ready to hurl.
What the hell was that?
Seth asked. He swayed in the entrance to the control area, supporting himself on one of the vertical beams. Shiny red lined his nostrils, then dripped into the stubble of his upper lip. Behind him, Doug leaned heavily on the catwalk's wooden railing. Alex coughed, pushed himself off the wall, and straightened up like a college professor addressing his class.
An idea my older counterpart and I have been working on. One might call it weaponized reality.
Veek gritted her teeth and plucked a shard of thin, curved glass out of her finger.
Weaponized what? Well, this specific reality,
Alex gestured at the controls.
I had Chase shrink the area of the machine's field while I triggered an overload. You sabotaged the safeguards just before the power was diverted into the secondary batteries, so the field's amplitude shot up to what would normally be dangerous levels.
Seth wiped his bloody nose on his sleeve.
And they're not dangerous now?
Dangerous is a relative term, said Alex. An animal can tear a pound of flesh from either your arm or your throat. Neither is healthy or pleasurable, but one is definitely better than the other.
Veek plucked another shard of glass out of her hand.
Will it work? That's the important thing. We are still alive and the machine is still standing, so I would presume, yes, it has worked. Which means what? Of that, I am less certain. We've driven it away from the machine, and it will require a certain amount of time to circle back around. We may have given ourselves an hour, perhaps more.
Chase stepped forward.
Give me the key.
I beg your pardon.
The key to the door.
Alex locked eyes with him.
I did what needed to be done. We did not have the time to free him, or an assurance he would not have sabotaged the machine as soon as he was inside.
Chase's fingers rolled up into his palm, but he kept his arm at his side.
Give me the goddamn key.
Alex slid the key from his pocket and held it out. Chase snatched it away and marched out to the catwalk. The clang, clang, clang of his footsteps echoed down the stairs.
It was a dick move,
Veek said, focusing on her hand.
Leaving him out there.
Alex furrowed his brows and moved to reset some of the dials.
I agreed it would be wrong to kill him, but I will not make an extra effort to save him, especially if such effort endangers the machine or any of us. You know, I've wondered what it'd be like to meet you for years now. I expected you to be a lot different. I am sorry to be such a disappointment to you, he said, but perhaps your world continuing to exist for the past 130 years balances the scales in some small way.
She squeezed her fingers around another sliver of glass and pulled it free with a wince. He went back to adjusting the controls.
Do you need help?
Asked Seth. Veek looked up at him.
I think I've got most of it. A lot of it was shallow. I could just shake it off.
Good.
Are you okay?
He glanced back over his shoulder, crouched a little lower, and focused his attention on her bleeding hand.
I am worried about Doug.
How so? Is something wrong?
His eyes are filled with blood.
Yeah, it's kind of a side effect of looking at the squales.
I think he may have looked too long.
You think it did something to him?
I do. In a way that makes me nervous.
Skinny hipster guy makes you nervous. I thought you used to be a cop.
Seth pinched a shard of glass between the nails of his thumb and index finger. He slid it out of her hand, and a drop of blood welled up behind it.
I was. That's why I know his behavior should make me nervous.
Thanks. What's he doing?
He's not blinking that often, said Seth. And he's eating.
Eating makes you nervous?
I don't know what he's eating.
He looks like a trail mix guy. Maybe he's got some in his backpack.
Seth shook his head and slid another sliver free from the edge of her thumb.
I never see or hear him open the pack.
Maybe you just missed it,
He snorted.
I wasn't just an honest policeman, I was a good one. He's not getting food from his pack.
Veek heard feet on metal. It wasn't a steady rhythm. Chase helped Murdoch limp down the catwalk. They turned a step over onto the control platform, and Murdoch's eyes somehow got even wider. He met her gaze, then shot an angry glare at Alex.
Just to be clear, said Murdoch, you people all suck.
His arms were cuffed in front, and Veek could see the deep gouges circling his wrists. Gummy, just starting to dry blood, edged each slash. Scratches and pinpricks covered his arms and some of his face. A red line went through his eyebrow, turned pink over his eyelid, and back to red on his cheek. He looked her in the eye again, then up at the banks of old instruments and tech around them.
This is amazing, he said. I've been hearing about this place my whole life, but I never thought it was real.
Veek snorted.
Even though you're part of the family?
A lot of people celebrate Christmas, said Murdoch, still looking at everything. Doesn't mean they think Santa's workshop is a real place.
So, Chase said, what's our next step?
He looked at Veek. So did Seth. And Murdoch. She shook her head.
Don't ask me.
She pointed at Alex. Alex looked back at all of them.
So we need to, what, turn up the volume on this thing? Asked Chase. That'll take care of it.
What do you mean?
The monsters, the squales. You're saying this machine makes some kind of barrier, a force field. So we turn it up, increase the amplitude or the charge, whatever it needs, and push them back to wherever they came from.
Alex shook his head.
I'm so sorry. I thought you understood.
Chase furrowed his brow.
Understood what?
Something cold settled in Veek's gut. Alex raised his arm, swept it to take in all the antique machinery.
Everything that can be done has been done. Even this was simply a feeble last-ditch effort. Our last round fired into the air to frighten the beast off. At this point, we are using paper tape to hold a sinking battleship together.
Veek cleared her throat, trying to force the cold thing out of her body.
And the battleship is?
Our world. The alpha predators, the squales, are here, in this reality. They are the end. The machine can do nothing now. They cannot be stopped. They cannot be pushed back into their last world like a genie of folklore back into his lamp.
Alex looked at Seth, at Doug, at Chase.
This world cannot be saved, my friends. It is already dead.
36. They all stood in the control area, staring at Alex. The man's shoulders slumped under his weather-beaten safari vest, and an air of complete exhaustion washed over him. Chase suddenly had no problem believing the man was over 160 years old, in spirit, if nothing else.
Well, there has to be something we can do, he said.
Alex shook his head.
There is not. But the weaponized reality thing,
said Veek.
We could do it again if your building and my building both did it at the same time. Maybe we could drive them away.
Your building in Los Angeles? Asked Doug.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably already gone, right? I mean, most of the city is at this point.
Seth let out a low whistle. Veek turned to him, blinked twice as she tried to focus on him.
Most of the... What?
Doug looked back at her with his blood-stained eyes, at Chase, back to Veek.
I thought you knew. They're all over the planet. Los Angeles, Rio, Shanghai, London, they're
attracted to major population centers on every world,
Alex said.
And they've made destroying the machine a priority, even if they hadn't. The nature of the machine makes the two poles a likely place for a major breach.
Veek shook her head.
But we don't know that. Maybe they...
She met Chase's eyes and he looked away. He knew that desperation. He'd worn the same expression when the police arrived to tell him they'd found Dina. Found her body.
The squale in Los Angeles, he said. It's been there for hours, at least 12 or 13 now. It was there before we even left our ship this morning.
Murdoch cleared his throat.
So, L.A. is gone?
Doug shrugged.
I guess. The streams I saw said it appeared downtown, and it's in Hollywood now. I mean, that's almost, what, a third of the city?
No, but it's a lot of it.
Murdoch looked at Veek.
And it's pretty much straight through Koreatown.
Veek shook her head again and swayed.
My friends are all there. My partner, they might be out looking for me, or the building might protect them. It saved us before.
Alex waved his hand dismissively.
The Los Angeles end of the machine suffered a catastrophic loss of function almost 14 hours ago. I tried to compensate at this end, but there was only so much I could do.
He glanced at Chase.
When I first found you down on the beach, I was looking for breaches. I expected one of the alphas would come through in this general area, but not quite so close.
Veek opened her mouth, snapped it shut. Her lips twitched. So did her fingers. She turned and walked out to the catwalk. She stared at the weird room with the door across from the control area, then spun back to face Doug.
Give me your phone.
I don't think you'll get a signal in...
Give me the damned phone!
He pulled it out and Veek snatched it from his hand. She marched down the catwalk toward the back of the building. They watched her go.
Doug cleared his throat. So, everyone's going to die?
Yes, that's correct.
Alex turned to examine a bank of dials. The needles on several of them wobbled to one side or the other. A few of them had dropped flat, already dead.
Everyone? Everyone in the whole world?
Yes, it's what they do.
What they've done for thousands of years to millions of worlds. They travel from reality to reality, devouring the earth again and again and again.
Seth pointed a finger at the ceiling.
That thing up in the sky.
Yes.
It eats planets?
Alex gave another tired nod.
So... We're talking about, like, a full multiverse, said Doug. Sort of like Crisis on Infinite Earths.
A bit overly dramatic, but that would be an accurate way to describe it. Well, actually, it's the title of a popular...
You've known all along, interrupted Chase.
I had hoped the situation wouldn't decline so fast, but yes, I suspected it was too late. I would have been... More clear sooner, if not for my doubts about Veek's loyalties.
Alex gestured at the antique controls around them.
I've done what I can to extend our time here, although the surge has affected that.
How?
We overloaded and destroyed 3 Transformers. If I had time, I could scavenge parts, combine them into a single working unit. We also burned out the emergency suppression system, although I don't believe we'll need it again anytime in our future.
The finality Chase had been running from for 2 years settled across his shoulders like a shroud. A tremor ran up his spine and shook his jaw.
How long do we have?
Alex tapped one of the dials, watched the needle bounce up and down.
We now know it's coming directly here with the goal of destroying the machine, possibly to clear a wider path to this world for some of the larger ones.
The larger ones?
Echoed Seth.
Oh, yes. I would guess this one will need another 40 minutes to turn itself around and return. If we replace those valves, we may slow it down and perhaps give us... another 10.
Chase looked around at the assembled machinery.
That's it? Not even an hour?
Alex coughed out a bitter laugh.
You have perhaps heard the analogy of man's relationship with God being like an ant's relationship with a man.
I don't think I believe in God anymore.
But you are all familiar with the analogy?
I've heard something like it, yeah.
So have I, said Doug. Seth grunted.
Then you must understand, Alex said. We are less than this to the Alpha Predators. We are less than bacteria to them, less than atoms. We are nothing. Once they are in a position to take action, we are completely powerless.
But bacteria can stop a larger creature, said Doug. They infect it, they fight back in their own way.
Alex sighed. Yes. I know this reaction. I had it myself for many years when I first learned of the Alpha Predators. It took me many years to get past it.
Chase bristled at the man's attitude.
What do you mean?
What reaction?
Hope. You want to believe there is another path, a way to fight back.
He shook his head.
There isn't. I searched for it for years and found nothing. These creatures, they are the absence of hope. They are the lack of all possibilities, of any options. I called them the end, because that is what they are. They are the end of all things for any world they reach. I have seen it happen 100 times.
That doesn't mean they can't be stopped.
It does not, said Alex. But they will not be stopped here. It's amazing we've lasted this long.
Doesn't feel amazing, said Seth.
Chase thought about Elizabeth, somewhere in Texas. Maybe already dead. Maybe one of the monsters was over Dallas right now, picking the city apart, going through the people like someone snacking on M&Ms.
I'm going to go check on Veek, he said, see if she got a signal for the phone.
Alex nodded.
We have more to discuss, all of us. Final arrangements to make here.
I'm never going to get to cut my documentary together, whined Doug.
Seth rolled his eyes.
Chase stepped out onto the catwalk. He looked through the machine, trying to spot a sign of Veek past all the tubes and cables and framework struts. After a moment, he just walked in the same direction she had. Near the back of the structure, the catwalk expanded out into a broad platform stretching wall to wall inside the building. A few tables and workbenches stood away from each other, each holding a range of tools. It reminded Chase of an old machine shop. Veek stood at the edge of one table, her hands flat on the surface. The phone rested between them, her head stretched back over her shoulders. As he watched, she took a long, deep breath and let it out slowly. Then another one.
You okay?
Yeah, she said. No. Freaking out. And I think I'm having an asthma attack, which isn't helping the freak out.
He kept his distance, let her breathe for another minute or so.
Good news,
she said with a very forced smile.
Enough of the machine has shut down that we can get a signal inside.
Bad news.
She smacked her hands twice on the table.
Nobody in L.A. is answering. The network's completely dead. I've tried Nate 3 times. I tried Zila, Mike, Jamie, even Roger. Everybody who lives in the building, that end of the machine. Nothing.
I'm sorry.
She shook her head, took another deep breath, let it out.
I don't care what he says, they're not dead.
What's his name?
Who?
Your partner. Well, if you're in Los Angeles, I guess she could be a she, right?
She looked up at him and raised an eyebrow.
You know being gay isn't just an L.A. thing, right?
Sorry.
But, yeah, he's Nate. His name's Nate.
And he's, you work together?
Yeah, work from home, we tell people.
She swallowed hard, let another breath hiss out of her nose. She looked at him, looked around the room. Her eyes brimmed with tears, just a few drops away from spilling over.
In my building, my end of the machine, this is a lounge.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's a bunch of couches and a TV. We watch movies, have staff meetings.
How many of you are there?
Me and Nate, Roger and Zila, Mike and Jamie, Debbie and Clive.
It's all couples?
No, I mean, it just sort of worked out that way. We all...
She stopped, took another deep, ragged breath.
Just give me a minute, I'll be fine.
No, you won't.
Jackass.
She held out the phone.
Do you want to try anyone?
He looked at the phone and thought of Elizabeth.
No.
Seriously?
I don't think I'm the one she'd want to hear from at the end of the world.
Chase stepped in and set his own hands on the other end of the table. Then he slid forward and leaned on his elbows, folded his hands back and rested his chin. He closed his own eyes.
When I found out Dina was dead, when they told me, I just kind of shut down. Elizabeth, my wife, she cried for 2 or 3 days. The only time she stopped was to sleep or to yell at me.
Why?
Because she needed to yell at someone and I wasn't reacting at all in her eyes. And because...
Yeah?
He took in a deep breath, felt his own eyes get a little watery.
Because it was my fault.
Was it?
What?
Was it your fault? You're not just being melodramatic?
He took in a breath, sighed.
Yeah, it was.
What happened?
He straightened up and pushed himself away from the table.
Sorry, I came out here to check on you, not to spill my guts.
Veek snorted.
Sounds like we don't have much time left. If you want to get anything off your chest, it's now or never.
You're kind of calm about this. I mean, the bigger picture stuff.
I've kind of known this was coming for a couple of years. The family almost shut down our machine, the LA half of the machine, a couple of years ago. Nate and I almost died then. One of our friends did. Tim. I hoped it'd never happen again, but...
But here we are.
Yeah. Here we are. I just figured all of us would be together there, fighting the good fight until the end.
Her dog got out. Arya.
You named your dog Arya?
Game of Thrones?
No, I get the reference, but why?
Small and vicious.
Veek managed a weak smile.
Fair enough.
I was trying to do sandbags around our house, and she ran outside after me. When it came time to head back in, I couldn't find her. We never did.
Dina freaked and wanted to go looking for her. When we told her no, she just slipped out and did it anyway. She didn't understand. It was more than just rain. He remembered telling her no. His last words to her. Her running off to her bedroom, crying for Arya. Veek said nothing while he remembered.
In a lot of places, it was just flooding. Water creeping up a foot or two, pretty much just sitting there, but it got really deep at points.
He looked down at the floor of expanded steel, past it to the lower catwalks.
They think she was wading along and either slipped into a deeper area by an underpass or maybe just waded out too far. There's just enough flow to drag her away from the shallows. She just drowned. Elizabeth and me, our marriage pretty much collapsed. She filed for divorce without even telling me. I found out when the guy showed up to serve the papers. She took Dina's ashes and moved to Dallas. Last time we spoke was a couple months later, the night before the divorce was finalized. She sounded impatient but kind of relieved like she'd finally gotten some closure. I knew our marriage was over, but I always hoped we'd at least be on speaking terms again someday.
Really?
Yeah. She was my friend before she was my wife. She nudged the phone toward him.
You should call her. Try anyway.
I don't even know her number. It's in my phone back on the Makara, which I think is in the squale stomach, or gullet. Whatever that thing digests stuff with.
No idea what it might be? The number?
Who actually remembers phone numbers anymore? It settled across his brain like a sheet snapped out across a bed and drifting down to cover it. A sheet, or another shroud. He'd never